So welcome. Hello. How are you doing? You're muted. That was a Zoom joke. Okay. Yeah, welcome. Welcome to you all. Tolstoy said, all happy families are alike, but each unhappy family is unhappy in its own way. And was thinking about that indeed the nature of dukkha is of suffering is charted meticulously in the Dharma, right? There are three species of suffering. There are four types of clinging. There are the fetters, there are the kilesas, there are the upa kilesas, the subtle kilesas. And if we are to be free, we must become connoisseurs of suffering, to be preoccupied with it, but to develop an extremely kind of nuanced perception and appreciation, honoring, and differentiation of suffering. And so, yeah, Tolstoy's got a point, but ultimately, I might say it's something the reverse of that line. I might say that dukkha is dukkha. All dukkha is dukkha. But freedom takes many, many forms. The manifestation of freedom takes many forms. Clinging, in a certain sense, maybe we say it's all of the same piece. But how the expression of relinquishment, what that actually looks like, is very highly varied. And indeed, the Buddha speaks much more about, as we've been talking about, what we're freed from rather than the manifestation of freedom, what freedom looks like. And I'm especially struck by the variety, the variations in practitioners and how spiritual maturation manifests of what it actually looks like, how it incarnates in a particular person, how it incarnates in one person, other. And I don't know, but I think it depends on a lot of factors, certainly on the lineage, so the kind of the cultural mores of the tradition in which one practices. All traditions, in a sense, have an archetype of enlightenment, of spiritual maturity, of what's celebrated, of what's most honored. And that influences how spiritual maturation looks in practitioners. And then there's the person's practice and their predilections and their particular path of insight. Some people, the elements of the path that they gravitate to may be very different than others. And this path of practice, how they practice, how they develop insight, shapes what their maturity looks like. But maybe most important in the mix, in terms of how freedom manifests, it seems to me that it depends on people's personality. That is, as we mature on this path, in a certain way, our personality, it becomes bigger, yeah, rather than smaller. It becomes more fully expressed in a certain way. But it's not a performance and it's not compulsive and it's not tangled up with greed and aversion, delusion. Personality is not itself a problem. It's when it gets tangled up, when it becomes driven, when there is a kind of egoic force behind it. And that egoic force leaks out onto others. But when we practice, as we come to know different aspects of freedom, in a sense, it can feel like somebody said, like, oh, I'm becoming the person I was, or something like this. These mature spiritual maturity, those practitioners often feel quite powerful, but empty. They feel like a kind of strong gust of wind, but with very little rigidity or fixation, defensiveness. So we keep saying freedom from rather than freedom to. But there's also a freedom to. Yeah, a freedom to what? Freedom to do what? One answer, I think the most important answer to my mind, it's freedom to love. To love more deeply, radically, boundlessly. That's what we're freed up to do. And awareness itself is a kind of letting go. It's a kind of letting go, like yeah. To know something is to let it go. To really know something is to let it go. And in the wake of letting go, the undefiled heart emerges. And so we start to see, like, oh yeah, greed, hatred, that actually requires clinging. And love merely asks that we let go. Last night, I think I alluded to that phrase of true nature. And in this tradition, we don't use that so much. But it's worth considering what's left in the wake of letting go. I don't know if we want to say true nature, but it's worth considering what's left in the wake of letting go. It's not hatred. Maybe you know the feeling, and it could be after a really blissful peaceful sit. It could be after a sit where you're in the trenches of purification, a deep grind. And the bell rings, and the thought of harming oneself, harming another, even subtly, is just so absurd. It's like so out of sync with the movement of the heart. And we start to appreciate this, that in the wake of letting go, there's something, I don't know if we always want to say it's love, but it's for sure non-hatred. Non-hatred. Now, sometimes the kind of cool, unruffled quality of emptiness seems self-alien from love. But I want to say that emptiness is not ethically neutral. It is responsive to the plight of the self. So, in other words, it's responsive to suffering. The kind of poignancy of self and selfing is so vivid from that mind that has released. And it can be scary, because at least at first, because we've not really loved from a place of letting go. We've loved from the ground. We've loved from the ground, not from groundlessness. In Stephen Batchelor's translation, I don't even know what sutta it is, but it's like, those who love their place is his translation. The Dhamma is difficult to detect, those who love their place. Yeah. We've manufactured our love in the house of self. And to begin to sense the love that arises in the wake of letting go, this is beautiful. The love that we say maybe is the face of emptiness, a spontaneous and effortless and potent, effective form of love. And it can feel like the most genuine thing we've ever done. More and more, the default position of our lives becomes the Brahmaviharas, the divine abidings of loving kindness and compassion, sympathetic joy and equanimity. That these are places of rest. These become more the default position of the mind. And we start to have more faith in love, more confidence in it. We begin to see that our experience itself when held with love, when held with wisdom, terminates in love. That if we follow the thread of experience and keep looking more and more deeply, there is more and more reason to love. And so with our anger, with our grief, with our agitation, with all of it, we follow that thread. We follow that thread, holding it with wisdom and a little seed of confidence, a little seed of confidence, like this ends in love. Now, generally, the kind of cool and warm, juicy side of practice converges. The wisdom and the love converge generally, but not always. Not always. And when they diverge, things get weird. And so there's a real value in training in love. Yeah, the two wings of awakening, the compassion side, the wisdom side, the heart side, the cool side. And we train in love because it is trainable. It is trainable. Our hearts can grow in ways that maybe we don't even imagine when we enter the path. And we train in love because our hearts and our ethical lives are profoundly influenced by the prevailing standards of our culture, society, for better and for worse. We are a very suggestible ethical creatures. Yeah. The standards we assign ourselves, these are how we actually behave, is profoundly influenced by the prevailing ideas about love, about sila, about ethics. Yeah, and so yeah, may our path be one of the causes, the conditions that suggest to us some radical ethical commitments. The Dalai Lama said, compassion is the radicalism of our time. And it's often said we as human beings, born far too early in a sense to survive, we depend, our life is literally owed to love, to care. We never would have made it without that. And, you know, we're probably gonna need love to survive as a species. And that love might take many shapes. Love takes many forms. Science, even science, bottom is a kind of love. But it's going to take something like love. Yeah. The tools we have at our disposal, they're just too potent now. And if they're wielded by the kilesas, we have trouble. It's going to take some love. So I want to say a little more about the love of which I'm speaking. And In Buddhism, it's often helpful to define one thing by saying what it's not, what masquerades as love. And so this kind of true love of which I speak is it's not the love that cover over injustice or demonize anger. Because we know that aversion, hatred, anger, these are considered defilement. It's very easy for all of that material to go underground in spiritual communities, to kind of avoid the tenderness and the messiness and the dependency, the interpersonal poignancy of navigating that. But we can't use love as a way of leapfrogging the thorniness of anger. And I noticed this in America's conversation about race, a kind of sometimes a proposal to jump into love and forgiveness immediately before actually seeing and feeling and to witnessing the kind of enormity of pain around the kind of legacy, a racist legacy. Yeah. And I was struck, I heard read somewhere that Gandhi said something like if it were only a choice between cowardice and violence, I'd choose violence. And then, of course, goes on to say, but I believe that nonviolence is infinitely superior to violence. The kind of love of which we're speaking is not, it's a strong love. It's a first love. The love of which we speak is not about some future. It's not the realm of kind of infatuation that invariably involves a lot of thinking. And sometimes there's something that it feels like, the future just got solved by this idea, this plan, this something. And that's a very fragile kind of love, a love that is about a future, a love that's not here now. The love that I speak about is not the kind of cheery Hallmark card love. It's not a love that's devoid of grief. Because we know that grief does not erase love, but informs it. The love that is not deeply acquainted with loss is a kind of naive love. And the development of this path, the development of wisdom, of compassion, is supported by a process of grieving. I can't help but circumambulate this theme, you know, this year, this 2020. But even before that, Yeah, there's something about the actual development of insight, making peace with dukkha, letting go, opening to the suffering of the world, opening to the harm done to us, opening to the harm done by us. All of this entails a measure of grieving. And in a way, it's like we must grieve the three characteristics before they become insight. You know, it's like to be asked to actually take in the truth of dukkha. That's no joke, you know, that's pretty epic. In some ways, it's the whole path, actually. It's like the truth contains all the other truths. And so the love of which I speak is informed by grief, informed by the changingness of all things. And then sometimes we confuse clinging and love. Yeah. Sometimes what happens is the love gets tangled up with clinging, and but they're different, right? The kind of generosity, it is the open hand to which Gil keeps alluding, and clinging is that clenched fist. And it's so natural for these things to become tangled up together, but we want to know just differently it feels to try and control something than to give something away. Yeah. Like how different it feels to try to control something than to give something away. And of course, the love is a kind of giving, a dana, generosity. So we detect when, as we can, when the kind of clinging tangles up with the love, when we entrust our heart to another and then to protect it by controlling them or what they think or how they love. Yeah, so these are some of the ways, things masquerade as love. So what kind of love is expressed in freedom? Well, in this tradition, letting go and love are closely connected. You know, there's no such thing as unrequited metta, you know. It's like there are no strings attached. It's not conditioned on you being a certain way, you reciprocating, you being how I want, you being any way, right? It's like it's actually offered without contingencies. And Wisdom is intertwined with this kind of love. Thich Nhat Hanh said this beautiful thing, like understanding is love's other name. That that's very touching to me. Here's what he wrote. If you pour a handful of salt into a cup of water, the water becomes undrinkable. If you pour the salt into a river, people can continue to draw the water to cook, wash, and drink. The river is immense, and it has capacity to receive, embrace, and transform. When our hearts are small, our understanding and compassion are limited, and we suffer. We can't accept or tolerate others and their shortcomings, and we demand that they change. But when our hearts expand, these same things don't make us suffer anymore. We have a lot of understanding and compassion and can embrace others. We accept others as they are, and then they have a chance to transform. Understanding someone's suffering is the best gift you can give another person. Understanding is love's other name. If you don't understand, you can't love. Understanding suffering is the best gift you can give another person. Understanding is love's other name. So this is a vision of love that is infused with wisdom. And last talk, I was kind of making the case that anatta is the deepest form of self-esteem. Yeah. That when we let go of self-view, there's a kind of a security that is afforded to us, and that security allows us to love more deeply. A million delights and loving connections and opportunities that might otherwise be blocked by self-view, that might be blunted, that the view acts as a kind of stack that interferes in heart connection. And so the hallmark, in a sense, of ego is defensiveness. Like, the hallmark is defensiveness. If we had to say, like, what is its characteristic, it is something like that, defensiveness. And what this means is that anything can be a threat. And that's a very fragile way of living. Sometimes I say, like, if I gave you an assignment, if I gave you an enormous, priceless, and very fragile vase, you know, and it's like so big you had to like carry it like this, you know, and I said, okay, go deliver that to some other town a few miles away. You can imagine how much you might miss delivering that vase across town. It'd be very hard to stop to help somebody. It'd be very hard to appreciate the sky. It'd be very hard to relax. And yet we effectively live our lives carrying around something that is huge and priceless and fragile. And as we become less attached, this opens space for our love to flow, but also for others to be who they are. And that creates a kind of reciprocal flow when the egoic pressure is not leaking out on others. They don't need to accommodate. They don't need to mold according to our own fragility. And so they can relax. And more love flows. And something a little magical about all of it, actually. So I've been talking about all about letting go. And maybe there's a controversial statement. I'm not trying to be a heretic here, but I also do want to note that of our freedom gives us the freedom to cling. Yeah. Just checking to see if my video's been cut off. I think I'm still on. Okay. Thanks for not cutting the mic, Yan Li. Yeah, so well, let me unpack this. What I mean, like, wait, what, the freedom to cling? How did that work, you know? I don't know, but I think there are some, maybe this is just the lack of spiritual maturity. But as far as I can tell, there are some relationships and some ethical commitments and some ways that we invest energy that effectively guarantee a measure of dukkha. Yeah. That I don't think there are ways of actually giving our heart to in the context of some relationships or some cause, some ethical commitment. I don't know. I don't think there's a way of doing it in a dukkha freer. But we kind of enter this knowingly and we consent to suffer. And that consenting to suffer changes in really dramatic ways from the ordinary dukkha where we can't believe we have to suffer. We can't believe that clinging brings a measure of suffering. And so I'm not trying to be provocative. I'm trying to like trace out what an engaged, an ethically engaged lay life might look like around this teaching. And some of what I feel our practice ends us with is something like the courage to grieve. Yeah. The courage to kind of weather the painfulness of clinging and be very discerning, but choose. Consent to the suffering we sign up for. Sometimes I wonder how many years would feel like enough. How long would I have to live for it to feel enough? Would it be 75, 100, 500, maybe even 1,000 years wouldn't feel like enough. But the practice Dharma satiates. Part of this love, part of this freedom is that we're not bent by mortality in exactly the same way. It's hard for people to know what would be enough, what would be enough of this life. But the Dharma satiates, it brings a sense of completeness to our life. Our life feels like, oh yeah, that was enough. Maybe I want more, but it actually, there's a sense of everything else is great. That was enough. Yeah, to be blessed by Dhamma, that's enough. And then the acquisitive mode, the acquisitive mode of owning, of having, of holding, this starts to fade away, and experience just so grateful for anything, you know. Michelle McDonald tells a story of interacting with this Burmese teacher, Sayadaw monk, and she said they're talking dana, you know, like often in the context of that means money, that is something like that, and he said something like, he's sort of teasing her and said something like, no, it's not. You're talking about Dana in this like very circumscribed way. It's like, no, this roof is Dana. Yeah. Your body. Your body is Dana. This breath is Dana. Yeah. So, with joyously. Our love becomes more radical, a kind of sort of the only point of anything in a way, really. And practice generates a kind of a surplus of well-being. We really are happy enough at some point. And then the question becomes like, how and on whom will I spend that surplus? And for me, it's been important, the kind of reflection of, you know, just knowing that so much of my lot in life is not, strictly speaking, morally deserved. You know, so much of my life is unearned. So much of the goodness, the good fortune is unearned. So I have to ask, like, how do I spend that surplus of well-being? On whom? Heart gets more radical. And it's a little strange, but knowing that we're walking a path of love, it cuts through a lot of anxiety about how this or that of our life turn out. So the philosopher Parfit wrote, if we are the only rational beings in the universe, as some recent evidence suggests, it matters even more whether we shall have descendants or successors during the billions of years in which that would be possible. Some of our successors might live lives and create worlds that, though failing to justify past suffering, would give us all, including some of those who have suffered, reasons to be glad that the universe exists. It for a moment. So thank you for your participation. And yeah, it's good to dwell to be able to talk about these things, matters of the heart, together, practice together. I'm grateful for that. Okay, see you later.